Epilogue. Two Promises. When Enrique first arrives in the United States, he promises himself two things: to leave drugs behind and to bring his daughter north quickly. 6 months after Maria Isabel arrives in North Carolina, Jasmine journeys north. The four-year-old girl travels with a trusted female smuggler. She crosses a river on a suspension bridge and is stashed away in the back of an 18-wheeler truck. Jasmine crosses the Rio Grande on an inflated inner tube, just like her father. She is caught by Border Patrol agents as she is entering the United States, but as a minor is quickly released to her parents, with an order to appear in immigration court at a later date. Jasmine runs toward her mother when she sees her. "Mommy," she cries. Maria Isabel sobs and embraces her. But Jasmine, a girl with crooked teeth, curly hair, and a big smile, keeps her distance from Enrique. "He is your father," Maria Isabel insists. Enrique bridges the divide by spoiling his daughter. On weekends, when Maria Isabel is cleaning hotel rooms, Enrique takes Jasmine to the Golden Corral, or McDonald's, or to the mall to buy clothes. He watches SpongeBob SquarePants and iCarly with her. With each day, Jasmine grows closer to her father. "You're my girl," Enrique says lovingly. Enrique and Maria Isabel are fearful of Jasmine being deported, and the girl learns to ride behind cars when she is on the street and sees immigration agents. In Florida, Jasmine becomes inseparable from her grandmother Lourdes. They spend so much time together, people assume Jasmine is Lourdes's daughter. They dress alike, wear their curly dark hair up in high ponytails, wear dangly earrings. Lourdes heaps so much love and attention on the girl that Diana gets jealous. "Everything I lost with Enrique, I am enjoying with her. Her childhood," Lourdes says. A lawless land. When Enrique moves his family to Florida, he rents in the same apartment complex as his mother. The gray apartments, built of cinder blocks, have large balconies in front of the second floor apartments. On Friday and Saturday nights, many Latino men, their work week done, gather on the balconies to sip beer and talk. Most are not in the United States legally, so they don't have bank accounts. They carry wads of bills from paychecks they received and cashed that day. To a group of African-American gangsters at the complex, the cash and the men's unwillingness to go to police to report crimes for fear of being deported make them ideal targets. One Sunday evening in December 2006, Enrique and three friends are sipping Coronas outside after the week's work painting houses. Enrique descends the stairs to his friend's balcony to take a call on his cell phone. Two attractive African-American women brush past him going up the stairs. They stop to flirt with his friends. Distracted, Enrique's friends don't notice a car with three African-American men that pulls up in front of their apartment. The gangsters jump out of their car and run up the stairs to the balcony. Enrique, determined to help his friends, turns to follow the men up the stairs. One of the gangsters, brandishing a gun, grabs Enrique and flings him over the railing. Enrique crumples to the ground. He gets up and runs. Two friends follow. Only one friend remains on the balcony. The gangsters demand that he hand over his cell, a gold chain he is wearing, and his wallet, which contains just $30. They order him to unlock his apartment door. Enrique's friend refuses. The gangsters punch him in the stomach. They grab his throat. They slam the back of his head. Finally, one of the gangsters swings a 12-gauge sawed-off shotgun at his face. The blow splits open his forehead. He staggers, then falls to the ground. Conscious, he lies still as a stone, holding his breath, pretending he is dead, afraid the gangsters will finish him off. Blood streams from his head. "He's dead," he hears one of the women say. The women and gangsters flee. 16 stitches in his head save Enrique's friend. But the robbery is the beginning of constant fear for Enrique and his family. For the next month, gangsters arrive at both Enrique's and his friend's apartment doors at 2 a.m. They knock loudly. "Police, let us in." Enrique peers out the peephole. It is not the police. One day, as he is sitting outside on a bench near the apartment playground, someone shoots at Enrique. Another night, someone rams into the front of his Toyota in the apartment parking lot, causing $2,000 worth of damage. Enrique and Lourdes believe the gangsters want to intimidate him so he does not report what he witnessed about the beating to police. "They wanted us to be afraid," Lourdes says. A month after Enrique's friend is pummeled and robbed, the same gangsters beat and rob a Mexican man who lives in the apartment directly below Lourdes's. Drunk and enraged, the Mexican man runs into his apartment, grabs his machete, and chases the three gangsters. As he closes in on the gangsters, one of them turns around and shoots the Mexican man three times. The man in his 20s falls to the ground, dead. In the spring of 2007, Lourdes's boyfriend finds that the three vans he uses for his house painting business have been broken into. He loses $13,000 worth of tools, including two new sprayers and a compressor. Latinos in the apartment complex start buying guns, fearful that gangsters might come into their apartments and kill their families. They stop sitting outside on benches by the playground, even during daylight. Lourdes's and Enrique's families don't go out at night, always keep their doors locked, and look through the peephole before opening the front door. "It is like we are dogs locked up in a cage," Lourdes says. "We have so much fear." Police step up patrols and yet never seem to be around when bad things happen. And as far as Enrique's family can tell, the beating of Enrique's friend, the murder of the Mexican, and the van break-ins all go unsolved. Enrique never reports any crime against him to authorities. Like most immigrants in the United States illegally, he fears that calling the cops will lead to deportation. Worse, Lourdes fears that because she went on Don Francisco's television show without disguising herself, and because many in the neighborhood have tied her to a best-selling book about undocumented immigrants, her family's odds of being deported are potentially higher. Instead of turning to police, Enrique and Lourdes opt to move. A bad move. In North Carolina, Enrique gave up glue sniffing. But in Florida, he meets new friends who use different drugs. His troubles with alcohol and prescription drugs come and go. He is usually a doting father and husband, a son who hugs his mother every morning and tells her he loves her. But there are times when Lourdes doesn't recognize her son. There are moments when Maria Isabel, who has become less shy and timid under Lourdes's tutelage, packs all of Enrique's clothing into garbage bags and tells him to get out. Sometimes he knocks on his mother's door in the middle of the night asking for money. At times he fails to pay the rent and even pawns the gold jewelry he bought himself, and then bracelets, chains, and rings he bought for Maria Isabel and Jasmine. "Mom, why are my dad's eyes like this?" Jasmine asks her mother. The girl asks Enrique, "Papi, why do you spend all of your time out in the street?" Enrique doesn't answer. Instead, he is so depressed, he thinks of killing himself or running away. But when Maria Isabel tells him to leave, Enrique appeals to his daughter for help. Jasmine turns to Maria Isabel and pleads, "Mom, why are you asking my dad to leave?" When Maria Isabel met Enrique, she was shy and giggled constantly. Now she cries, a powerful mourning that comes from deep hurt he has caused. In 2010, Lourdes convinces Enrique and his family to move back in with her. Her presence, she hopes, will help her son. Also, Enrique can help her cover her rent. Ever since the real estate bubble burst in 2007, which hit Florida particularly hard, Lourdes and her longtime boyfriend have struggled financially. Lourdes's boyfriend has to let go his crew of 20 painters. He begins working for an hourly rate. If there is no work locally, he roams from Georgia to Key West for jobs. Lourdes helps keep the family afloat by caring for two elderly Floridian siblings. When Lourdes goes out on an errand, she invites Enrique to come along. There alone, she talks to him. "You must change," she tells him. "What kind of role model are you providing for your daughter? Have you ever seen me drunk or on drugs? You should cherish Maria Isabel, who has stayed with you for the sake of your daughter. You will never find a woman like this again," Lourdes tells Enrique. "Don't be a coward. Don't let drugs dominate you." Enrique used to shut down any conversation like this, wouldn't let his mother get a word in about his problems, or he'd berate her, saying he never would have started sniffing glue if she hadn't left him. If she had always been there to discipline him, he would have been a good son. Now he listens and cries. "Sí, ma, yo sé." "Yes, Mom, I know," Enrique murmurs. "Es que no puedo. It's hard. I can't." "Sí puedes," Lourdes answers. Ever since arriving in the United States, she has told herself she is a strong person, free of fear. "I thought I could do anything," Lourdes says. Now she turns to God for help. She joins an evangelical church and takes 3 years of courses that allow her to become an intercedora, a leader that can put hands on people and pray for them. In April 2010, Lourdes marries her boyfriend in keeping with the teachings of the church. Her daughter Belki follows in her footsteps, joining an evangelical church in Honduras and marrying her longtime boyfriend, Giovanni, the same month. For Lourdes, faith helps her manage disappointment. "Since I came from Honduras, all I wanted was to have my children study, be well raised," Lourdes says. Belki never finishes college. She makes and sells fruit pops. Diana drops out of high school half a credit short of finishing. She talks of being a police officer, but instead goes to work selling telephone plans for $9.50 an hour. A fateful robbery. In 2010, Diana and Hasmin sit behind the glass counter of the telephone store where Diana works. Business is slow. They are watching a movie. A man walks in and asks Diana about the company's prepaid telephone plans. Suddenly, he whips out a gun. He points it at Hasmin and Diana's faces. Hasmin 9 starts crying. So does Diana. The man tells them he doesn't want to rob them, but he needs cash to flee the police and get out of town. Diana tells him to turn to God for help. He starts crying and demands Diana empty the cash register. When the man runs out of the store, Diana dials the police and tells Hasmin to run outside and describe the man's getaway car. Moments later, using the information Hasmin provided, the police catch the robber, who has a long rap sheet. 2 years later, that random robbery is what may save her own father from harm. Maria Isabel's vow. Lourdes has always stood by Enrique no matter what. She feels her love has moderated his worst behavior. She vows that she abandoned him once but will never do it again. She has promised herself to be a loving mother, the opposite of her own stepfather, who inflicted physical abuse on Lourdes as a child. In 2011, Lourdes devises another plan to set her son right for good. Maria Isabel has turned 30, and although Hasmin desperately wants a sister, Maria Isabel refuses. How could she afford a babysitter, which cost $100 a week, when she works furiously every day cleaning 20 rooms at a local hotel, but after 5 years only makes $8.40 an hour? The recession means empty hotel rooms, and sometimes she doesn't get a full 8-hour day. A babysitter would consume nearly half of her take-home pay. Besides, Enrique sometimes uses his paycheck to go out carousing at night. Lourdes tells Maria Isabel one thing will transform Enrique. Give him a son. Maria Isabel doesn't buy this. He hasn't changed for Jasmin, has he? But in October 2011, when she runs out of birth control pills, she doesn't go buy more for 5 days. She has heard erroneously that if you have been on the pill a long time, you won't get pregnant. A gift. On Christmas Eve, Enrique is nowhere to be found. Lourdes, furious, has a talk with Maria Isabel. We have to cut him loose. He finally comes home the day after Christmas at 3 a.m. He knocks hard on his mother's bedroom door. He wants $20. You know I don't have cash, she says from bed. Enrique persists. Lourdes's husband finally gives him $20 so he can go back to sleep. Lourdes, wide awake, talks to God and asks for something unthinkable to her before. If this is the life he is going to lead, please take him away from me, she says. Enrique's future, she tells God, is out of her hands. She won't ask God to help him anymore. She tells the devil she will no longer give him the satisfaction of seeing her shed another tear over her son. Exhausted, Lourdes falls asleep. She has a dream. She is wandering, searching for some place with Enrique cradled in her arms. A woman and two men offer to help. Then they start laughing at her naivete. Does she really think we will help her? They morph into Satan. They start battling her, and Lourdes prays to God to help her. The strongest of the three approaches Lourdes. I will destroy you, he says. Lourdes laughs, strong in her faith. But then Satan picks up something that terrifies Lourdes, a serpent. He presses the head of the snake to her face as its long, cold body drapes down next to hers. Lourdes summons all her strength, squeezes the serpent, and throws it to the ground. It explodes. The three Satans dissolve. Lourdes awakes at dawn covered in sweat, her legs so weak they wobble. She slides down to the floor, to her knees, and prays. She vows to God she will never again ask him for anything for her son. Enrique has spent the night drinking with friends at a rundown brick motel, with brown shutters and plywood patches on some of the doors. He returns home late in the afternoon, not having slept in 3 days. Enrique goes into his mother's bedroom. Lourdes has left her wedding ring on the dresser, a gold band with one square diamond. Enrique grabs it. He tells himself he will pawn it and get it back with his next paycheck. At 8 p.m. that night, Jacksonville sheriffs arrive at the motel where Enrique and four others are in a room drinking. Sheriffs discover Enrique has an outstanding order of arrest for not paying a ticket 3 years before for driving without a license, a traffic violation. As part of the wave of local and state anti-illegal immigrant laws passed in recent years, most states no longer allow undocumented migrants to get driver's licenses. He spends the night in jail, expecting to be arrested. When Maria Isabel, 3 months pregnant, learns of his arrest, she cries hysterically. Locked up. In 2008, the federal government began rolling out a program every police department in the country had to implement by 2013. If someone is arrested for any reason, their fingerprints must be sent to federal immigration authorities, who will deport people who are in the United States illegally. As the federal program was adopted by thousands of police departments, deportations increased 40% between 2006 and 2011, a year when the United States deported more than 400,000 immigrants nationwide. During those same 5 years, Florida nearly doubled the number of undocumented immigrants it had in its jails any given night. Increasingly, families like Enrique's are being separated again, this time in reverse. Parents are being deported back to Central America, away from their U.S.-born children. About 200,000 parents of U.S. citizen children were deported between 2010 and 2012, and 5,000 parentless children are in foster care because their mother or father was detained or deported. The increased deportations put Enrique's family and migrants around the country in a state of constant fear. Jasmin, a girl who loves Justin Bieber, puppies, and dolphins, and dons a reflective belt to man her post every weekday as the student safety officer at her elementary school, is afraid each morning when her mother walks out the door to go to the grocery store or on an errand. "I worry," the girl says, "about my mom being deported." The day after Enrique's arrest, sheriffs hand him over to immigration authorities, who place him at Baker County Detention Center in McClenny, Florida, and begin deportation proceedings. Baker County sets aside one of its two wings just for immigrant detainees. The county receives nearly $85 per day from the government to hold immigrants, an average of $21,264 per night in fiscal 2011. The immigrant wing has 8 locked areas, each with a high-ceilinged common area and 2 stories of cells along the perimeter. The inside of the jail is stark. The walls are cinder blocks painted eggshell. The floor is gray concrete. At night, immigrants are locked into their cells, which sleep 2 or 4 detainees. Enrique tries to sleep atop the thin brown mattress on the narrow steel bunk bolted to the wall of his cell. The TV blares until midnight. Metal doors clang open and shut all night. Earplugs are prohibited. He cannot sleep. Purple rings circle his eyes. County inmates are offered GED classes and Alcoholics Anonymous sessions. Immigrants are not. A cart arrives, but Enrique sees only books in English, Russian, and French. Enrique understands everything the guards say and speaks passable English but cannot read it. During the day, he is allowed out of his cell into a common area, which has 4 stainless steel picnic tables and 1 TV. English and Spanish language speaking migrants fight over what channel to tune into. Federal detention standards entitle immigration inmates to an hour of outdoor recreation. Jails lacking an outdoor area can substitute a large recreation room with free-flowing air and natural light. In Enrique's jail, the recreation room has 1 ping-pong table and 2 Y-screens for more than 240 inmates. Air and light come from 1 window at the top of the 2-story room. The only time Enrique feels sunlight on his face is when he has a dental emergency. He can petition after 6 months to move to a jail with an outdoor area, but it would take him away from his family. Instead, he paces, does push-ups, or plays chess because it takes a long time to finish a game. At night, he reads a Bible a prison chaplain gave him. The only break from the monotony is when visitors arrive. Enrique cannot see them in person or even through plexiglass. He must view them on 1 of 2 video screens in the prisoner's common area right outside his cell. A journalist's decision. Lourdes looks for help. In January 2012, she calls me. Enrique is locked up, she says, and she must find a lawyer. Journalists usually don't get involved personally with people they write about, because we must convey reality to readers, not write about a reality we have altered. Our credibility depends on playing it straight with readers, on not taking sides. There is a clear exception to the no-involvement rule. If someone is in imminent danger, we should help them, if we can. And then we must disclose what we have done to readers. I had followed how increasingly dangerous Honduras has become. The country now has the highest homicide rate in the world, according to the United Nations. Large swaths of Honduras, including Enrique's family neighborhood, have fallen under the control of gangs like the Zetas. Mexico's most violent narco-trafficking organization, as they fight for territory to move drugs to the world's largest consumer, the United States. The Zetas and other gangs impose an impuesto de guerra, a war tax on bus drivers and business owners. At the taxi stand near Enrique's neighborhood, the Zetas enforcer shows up every morning with a checklist of drivers. Anyone who hasn't paid the daily $13 tax is threatened or killed. No one calls police, who are widely viewed as in league with the shakedowns. Belky marvels that in just one weekend, 38 people were murdered in Tegucigalpa, a city of 1.1 million. Relatives can't afford a box or burial, so the government puts victims into mass graves. I learned that four of Enrique's close family members were getting texts and telephone calls with death and extortion threats. The family changed phone numbers and stopped going out at night. My book has made Enrique famous in his neighborhood and in Honduras, where three prominent TV shows about the book have been widely viewed. When Belky went to the U.S. Embassy to request a visa to visit the United States again, the official told her, "You are the famous one, the one on TV." To instill fear and earn greater notoriety, gangs in Honduras target and kill famous people. They had already murdered a previous president's son and a well-known journalist. "If Enrique comes back, he is going to die," Belky told me. I contacted several lawyers in Florida to help Enrique. His story had inspired changes in laws in Mexico and prompted readers to build schools, water systems, and help establish job-generating businesses in Central America and in Mexico. Every day, readers emailed that the book had changed their views by broadening their perspective and educating them about the migrants in our midst. I asked lawyers, would they help? Two married Miami attorneys, Sui Chung at Immigration Law and Litigation Group, and Professor Michael S. Vasteen, director of the Immigration Law Clinic at St. Thomas University School of Law, stepped forward. Chung, the daughter of South Korean immigrants and a passionate advocate for human rights, had launched a project in South Florida to represent mentally incompetent immigrants facing deportation. Like all unlawful immigrants, the mentally ill aren't entitled to a government attorney, even though some face danger when they are deported home. Chung takes on half our cases for free. The two lawyers would pour more than $100,000 in billable hours into Enrique's case for free and pursued two legal strategies: that either a past trauma or a future one he might face should save Enrique from deportation. They claimed the U.S. government should allow Enrique to stay in the United States by awarding him political asylum because his notoriety would make him the target of the Zetas in Honduras. Some immigration judges deny 90% of asylum claims. Others approve the same percentage. Enrique's judge, James Grimm, has a higher-than-average denial rate, 77%. A son. On July 2, 2012, Maria Isabel goes into labor. Enrique, awaiting the outcome of his asylum claim, has been locked up for 6 months. He is in jail 35 miles away. When the contractions intensify, Maria Isabel grabs Lourdes's left forearm and digs her nails in, trying to cope with the pain. Lourdes tells her she can give birth without an epidural to be strong. Daniel Enrique is born at 5:38 the next morning. His head emerges with the umbilical cord wrapped around his neck. He is purple from lack of oxygen. But he is a fighter. He draws in a big breath and then puts his thumb into his mouth, hungry. Enrique has now missed the birth of both of his children. When he hears about his son's birth, Enrique momentarily considers signing papers to be deported to Honduras, despite the risk of being killed there. He feels frustrated hearing that friends and relatives who were deported are back in the United States in just 1 or 2 months. Enrique feels so stressed and depressed, he cannot sleep. They put him in solitary confinement, a cell with a camera for overnight observation. He complains, and they put him on an antidepressant. Lourdes talks sense back into her son, urging him to think about all the time his attorneys have put into his case. She tells him he will be targeted and killed in Honduras. She reminds him that any journey north will be more dangerous than ever. In 2011, prodded by human rights activists and accounts such as Enrique's journey, Mexico passes a law allowing Central Americans to transit legally through their country. But the good done by that law is canceled out by the CETA's seizing control of the central train route Enrique once took. People pretending to be smugglers turn migrants over to the narco-trafficking cartel. The CETAs beat and torture people to obtain information about relatives in the United States and demand ransom from them. They especially target children, because they are most likely to have relatives willing to do anything to piece together the ransom required for their release. In 2010, an 18-year-old relative of Enrique's set off for the United States and disappeared. In 2012, a 16-year-old who left from Enrique's neighborhood was kidnapped in Mexico and tortured. In a 2012 report, Human Rights Watch said that about 18,000 Central American migrants were being kidnapped each year crossing into Mexico. Those who don't have money are killed. Enrique's cousin, who made the journey in 2012, estimates that a third of migrants get kidnapped. If Enrique gets deported, returns to the United States, and again gets caught by police, the consequences could be severe. His attorneys have seen clients with no criminal history get 8 years in jail for re-entering the United States without permission. Enrique, who still has a scar and bump on his forehead from his journey in 2000, decides to stay put. On July 8, 2012, 5 days after the birth of his son, Enrique calls me collect. He thanks me for my help. Enrique acknowledges his troubled past, but argues that everyone should have a chance at redemption. We should all have a chance to change. He says he wants to focus on his children, his wife, his mother, and himself. I want to do something with my life. 11 days after Danielle's birth, Judge Grimm denies Enrique's claim to political asylum on all counts. Grimm says he doesn't find Enrique credible because of inconsistencies in his stated drug use. Enrique, the judge says, is afraid simply because gangs want to extort money from him like they do everyone else. Grimm says Enrique is in danger going back to Honduras, but hasn't met specific criteria for asylum, proving he is part of a persecuted group. On July 19, 2012, he orders Enrique deported. Enrique watches the judge rule from a video camera at Baker County Detention Center. It is one of the worst moments of his life. The next month, his attorneys appeal. Michael Vasteen, an expert on migrants with drug convictions, believes Enrique's life shouldn't be endangered because he had a 2005 conviction for being caught with a small amount of marijuana and cocaine residue, a felony. In 2000, the U.S. Congress created a U visa that allows migrants to stay legally in the United States if they are victims of a crime, provided that they report that crime and then help prosecute the perpetrator by serving as witnesses. Congress envisioned the U visa as an invaluable tool to encourage migrants frightened of coming forward and cooperating with police, because doing so could result in deportation or retaliation from gangs. Sui Chong believes the visa helps make many communities safer by giving migrants a powerful incentive to cooperate with authorities. Enrique's attorneys offer local law enforcement authorities testimony in the beating Enrique witnessed. Law enforcement must certify that a person has cooperated in an investigation to be able to apply for the visa. Meanwhile, congressional leaders had begun fighting about whether to curtail the visa program. The U.S. Senate approved increasing the number of U visas allowed annually to 15,000 from 10,000. They wanted to increase the incentive for frightened victims to come out of the shadows. But critics in the U.S. House of Representatives are incensed that this is the one visa where even aggravated felons aren't barred. What's more, they say, there is no numerical cap to the number of family members of victims who can get the visa. Granting a path to citizenship, they say, isn't proportional to helping police solve a crime. They are working to disallow the path to citizenship afforded by the visa. In the summer of 2012, local sheriffs reject Enrique's request. They tell Enrique's attorneys that when the police report on his friend's beating was filed, Enrique wasn't listed as a witness. They do not consider Enrique's initial fear of approaching authorities because he believed he would be deported. Enrique's attorneys have one last hope. It comes from Jasmin, the girl Enrique left behind. Jasmin testifies against the man who held her at gunpoint in a robbery. Enrique's attorneys apply for her to be granted the U visa. Any person granted the visa who is 21 or younger can petition to have family members, including parents, stay in the United States legally as well. How humanitarian would it be, Chung and Vasteen argue, at a June 2012 hearing, to allow Jasmin to stay if her parents are deported? They wait for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security Citizenship and Immigration Services Processing Center in St. Albans, Vermont, to decide Jasmin's and her parents' fate. Separated by a screen. On September 23, 2012, a Sunday afternoon, Lourdes drives down a four-lane highway framed by towering pines to the Baker County Detention Center. Each Sunday after church, she, Jasmin, and Danielle, and Maria Isabel, when she isn't working, visit Enrique. She and Jasmin each grab one side of the baby carrier's handle. They lift Danielle and carry him between them. They walk past a large American flag fluttering in the fall breeze and toward the one-story building with a green faux stone facade. The guard at the visitation desk waves them over to video screen number 9, one of 15 monitors, each in their own cinderblock visitation stall. Prisoners are never allowed to see loved ones in person. The small black screen flickers on. Jasmin can see inside Enrique's jail unit. Soon, in an orange prison jumpsuit, Enrique approaches and sits before his screen. Jasmin lifts a telephone receiver to talk. For 9 months, ever since Enrique has been locked up, this is the only way she has been able to see her father. When she first came, she was scared to go with Lourdes to the jail guard to sign in. Instead, she quietly sat in the corner of the visitation room, trying to catch a glimpse of Enrique on the far-off screen. Today, she scoots her chair across the shiny linoleum floor closer to the screen. She misses her father's hugs. Lourdes stands next to Jasmin and holds Danielle, who has chubby cheeks and tufts of black hair and is dressed in a white onesie, up to the screen. "Look here! You are going to see your daddy," Lourdes coos. Jasmin cradles the receiver to Daniel's ear. "Say hello, papi," Jasmin tells her brother. Enrique smiles at his son, revealing two teeth, still broken from his train ride. Lourdes tells Enrique his son is just as demanding as Enrique was at a baby. He always wakes up cranky, pouts his lips, puts his forearm across his eyes. Caring for this boy, so like what she remembers of Enrique as a baby, makes Lourdes smile. Enrique looks at his son through the screen, emotion dancing in his eyes. I am your father. Behave yourself. Stop being difficult with your grandma. His voice softens with love. Enrique waves at his screen. How is my boy? His brown eyes transfixed, Danielle looks at Enrique. He drools and gurgles into the receiver. Finally, Lourdes readies to leave, to be separated from Enrique for another week. I love you a lot, she tells him. Enrique braved 8 attempts through Mexico to find his mother. But some Sundays these goodbyes are more than he can endure. When he first saw Danielle, his arms ached to hold him. Sometimes he asks them not to visit. It is too hard not to hug Jasmin. He has never cradled or touched his own son. Faith and prayers. Just before coming to the jail, Lourdes and Jasmin head to an evangelical church in a scrappy part of Jacksonville. Inside the sunny stucco building is a cavernous room, painted in bright Caribbean colors. As the service begins, all of the hundreds of worshipers, who are immigrants from Colombia, Honduras, and Cuba, rise from their purple cushion chairs to dance and sing. I will rejoice in Jehovah, Lourdes sings as she claps and dances in her gold-sequined platform shoes. He has taken away all of my pain. Jasmin, 11, stands next to her, rocking her 2-month-old brother in his bassinet. They sing of another migrant, Moses leading the Jews out of slavery in Egypt, parting the Red Sea, entering Jordan to the Promised Land. They sing of how the ocean closed and swallowed up the advancing Egyptian army and Pharaoh. The preacher bellows to parishioners, "When you sing the ocean parts, Jordan is before you, and your enemies have been destroyed." "Thank you, God," Lourdes says. For 3 hours, as she does every Sunday, Lourdes, clutching a large Bible, dances and sings and prays. She asks God to forever rid her son of his addictions and to save him from deportation and death. For if he is deported, a migration saga that began with Enrique's mother departing from Honduras will begin anew. Enrique will be separated not only from Jasmin, but also from his newborn son. An answer. In August 2013, Enrique receives the miracle he has prayed for, a visa to stay in the United States legally. Jasmin and Maria Isabel obtained similar visas 2 months earlier. Enrique had enormous luck. His story moved 2 tenacious Miami attorneys to represent him pro bono and tirelessly fight his case. Every day, hundreds of families are not as lucky. They are again being torn apart. Afterward. Immigrant Nation. An estimated 1 million children live illegally in the United States, most of them from Mexico and Central America. Like Enrique, almost all have spent time away from a parent before following him or her to the United States. Today, 1 in 4 children in the nation's schools is an immigrant or the child of an immigrant, up from just 6% in 1970. By 2020, these children will constitute 30% of the nation's school population. Children leaving Central America to find their mothers in the United States now face a tougher, more treacherous journey than ever before. In the south of Mexico in particular, they are likely to be kidnap victims. To the north in Nuevo Laredo, along the Rio Grande, where Enrique camped, there are raging battles between drug cartels. The body of El Tirindaro, the smuggler who crossed Enrique into Texas, was found in February 2002 near the road to the Nuevo Laredo airport. He had been blindfolded, tortured, and shot in the head execution style. El Tirindaro, whose full name was Diego Cruz Ponce, was one of 57 murders in Nuevo Laredo that year, and the violence has gotten much worse since then. The Seta narco-trafficking organization seized control of Nuevo Laredo, and the city became a war zone. Shootouts in broad daylight became common. Bodies were hung from bridges, and the mayor's office was bombed. Local newspaper reporters stopped covering the drug violence after their offices were hit with a grenade launcher. In 2005, the new police chief, who vowed to bring law and order to the city, was gunned down hours after taking office. Migrants were at the center of the growing violence. They were abducted in large groups from buses or the tops of trains. In 2010, on a Mexican highway leading to the Texas border, 72 migrants, most from Central America, were pulled off a bus and taken to a ranch by the Zetas, who shot and killed the migrants one by one. Later that year, the bodies of 193 migrants were found in clandestine graves nearby. Police were led there by Zeta members who confessed to kidnapping and killing bus passengers, often migrants. In December 2010, some 50 Central Americans were abducted after the train they were on was stopped and held up by gunmen in the southern state of Oaxaca. The same thing happened 2 years later to 40 Central Americans in Veracruz. Amnesty International, which has launched a public campaign to highlight what it says is among the most dangerous journeys in the world, has called on the Mexican government to protect migrants. Mexico's National Human Rights Commission has found that almost half of the victims it interviews say public officials are involved in their kidnapping. Along the length of Mexico, more and more pregnant women and parents with young children have been riding freight trains. Some parents carry babies in their arms. Between 2001 and 2004, the number of Central American migrants detained and deported each year by Mexico nearly doubled to more than 200,000. Most came from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, and were trying to reach the United States. But between 2005 and 2010, the recession cut jobs for migrants, so fewer headed north, and the number of Central American migrants caught in Mexico dropped by 72%. In 2012, as the U.S. economy brightened, the numbers apprehended in Mexico ticked up. In the summer of 2012, a friend of Enrique's got on a train in Chiapas, loaded with 1,500 other migrants. The number of adults arriving unlawfully in the United States is at a 40-year low. But the number of children, like Enrique, coming alone has recently surged to record levels. In fiscal 2011, U.S. immigration authorities caught and detained some 24,000 children, mostly from Central America, nearly quadruple the number from 2 years before. At least another 12,000 Mexican unaccompanied minors were caught and immediately deported in 2013. Experts estimate that for every migrant who gets caught, there are two or three who don't, which means more than 100,000 children came to the United States unaccompanied by a parent or other adult that year. These children are fleeing drug violence, forced recruitment into gangs, and poverty, and as Enrique was, they are searching for their mothers. The U.S. government has sought to house this surge in youngsters in 53 detention centers in 12 states. However, in 2012, these centers exceeded capacity. The federal government had to tap Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, and set up temporary tent facilities to house the overflow. They eventually added 900 beds to the 2,800 that already existed in detention centers for children. Before 1990, immigrants went overwhelmingly to six states. But with the new influx of legal and illegal immigrants, 27 million in two decades, many migrants went to places that hadn't seen new immigrants in generations. Large numbers of Latino immigrants who spoke Spanish and had different customs arrived in states where the locals rejected rapid change and were hostile toward the newcomers. Legislators acted on that hostility, ushering in the biggest crackdown on unlawful immigrants in decades. Since 2006, the record numbers of unlawful migrants arriving, coupled with the hostility spurred by a recession, sparked a wave of local and state laws aimed at addressing unlawful immigration. These measures, meant to make life so miserable for immigrants that they will self-deport, prohibit migrants from renting apartments, getting driver's licenses, and securing jobs. Six states banned giving in-state tuition to students who are in the United States unlawfully. New Jersey and Florida tried to ban the lower tuition for U.S.-born children of undocumented immigrants as well. That move was rejected by state courts. States like Alabama denied immigrant students who were in the United States unlawfully the right to go to college, even if they were willing and able to pay higher out-of-state rates. 12 states passed laws allowing these students to pay in-state tuition. Between 2005 and 2010, nearly 1,000 laws addressing illegal immigration passed state legislatures. Police find themselves now having to act under a federal mandate as de facto immigration agents, arresting and handing over unlawful migrants to federal immigration authorities. Six states, led by Arizona in 2010, passed sweeping legislation against illegal immigrants. The laws caused migrants to live in greater fear. The issue remains as controversial as ever, and the questions the same. Is immigration good for the migrants themselves? Is it good for the countries from which they are migrating? Is it good for the United States and its citizens? Effect of immigration on migrants. For immigrants, the practical benefits of coming to the United States are clear. The money Lourdes sent Enrique allowed him food, clothing, and to attend school longer. Once he arrived in the United States, Enrique drove his own pickup truck and could make a decent living if he worked hard. Enrique loves how clean the streets are compared to those in Honduras, how most people respect and obey the laws. His aunt Miriam noted that the United States is less class-driven than Honduras. Here, people don't look down on her if she dresses humbly. Lourdes enjoys having indoor plumbing, a government relatively free of corruption, and the freedom to get in her car and go anywhere she wants. Enrique acknowledges drawbacks that were clear to him before he was jailed. He must live in the shadows, knowing he can be deported at any time. He faces racism. When he goes into a restaurant and can't order well in English, he gets dirty stares. "They look at you as if you are a flea," he says. Salespeople in stores often attend to Anglo customers first. Even Mexicans look down on Central Americans. Often employers pay immigrants less than they pay citizens and assign them the most unpleasant tasks that no one else wants to do. Immigrants were harder hit by the recession and faced higher unemployment rates than American workers. A study by the Pew Research Center found that Hispanic household wealth dropped 66% during the recession, more than that of any other racial or ethnic group. Enrique scrambled sometimes to find work painting houses. Life in the United States, Enrique and others say, is too hurried. In Honduras, people work half a day on Saturday and rest on Sunday. There is time to be with your family and enjoy a meal together. Here, Enrique paints 7 days a week in an endless struggle to pay bills. Here, he says, life is a race. Newcomer traumas. For most migrants, the biggest downside to coming to the United States is the damage caused by years of separation for parents and children. That toll is most evident inside places like Los Angeles's Newcomer School, a transitional school for newly arrived immigrant students. There each day, the school's soft-spoken counselor, Gabriel Murillo, finds the small wooden box outside his office full of request to see the counselor slips. More than half of the 430 high school students will ask to see him by year's end. The reason? Problemas familiares, they write. Family problems. Most have recently reunited with a parent, usually a mother. On average, they have not seen the parent in a decade. Hour after hour, parent-child meetings play out with a scary similarity, Murillo says. Murillo sees some children who feel resentful even before coming north. Others have deeply buried anger that emerges after months with their mothers. Inside Murillo's office, children usually fire the first salvo. I know you don't love me. That's why you left me there. The children say their mothers lied to them from the start, promising to return quickly. They prayed that the border patrol would catch their mothers and send them back, arguing that they would rather be together even if it meant going hungry. They demand that their mothers admit their mistakes and apologize for leaving them. They tell their mothers they would never leave their own children. They tell them they are worse than animals. Even an animal doesn't desert her litter. Some children are angry because they had to leave behind the people who loved and nurtured them most, their grandmothers, who might now suffer a loss of their only source of income. What if they never see their grandparents again? Some children are resentful because they were abused or neglected by their caretakers or bullied by others back home. One in 20 girls at the school admits to being molested by a male relative. They blame their mothers for not being there to protect them. Mothers demand respect for their sacrifice, insisting that the separations were worth what was gained. They see their children as ungrateful brats. These scars are often irreparable or take years to heal. Los Angeles Unified School District psychologist Bradley Pilon believes only 1 in 10 immigrant students ultimately accepts his or her parent and puts the rancor behind them. Often mothers lose what is most important, the love of their children. Mothers expect to finally have the perfect family when their children arrive. Instead, they face rejection and constant fights. Children who thought they would find love and an end to loneliness discover that they feel more distant than ever from their mothers, even though they are now with them. Actions by both mothers and children make matters worse. Children act out, doing everything possible to push their mothers away. It is their way of testing whether their mothers really love them, whether they can trust them, whether their mothers will abandon them again. Mothers, beset by guilt, don't discipline their children or set rules. To pay off their debts to the smugglers, they often work overtime, and after so much time apart, children feel their mothers are ignoring them again. Some mothers continue to work as live-in nannies or housekeepers after their children arrive. They place their children in an apartment with relatives or friends, calling at night, visiting on weekends. The conflicts Murillo sees are most acute when the child was the last to be brought north because the mother couldn't afford to bring everyone at once. Such children come to believe that the mother favored the children she brought north first. The clashes are also severe when the mother has a new husband or has given birth to additional children in the United States. Some mothers, fearful of how children left behind would react, have hidden these new families from them. Newly arrived children try to create conflicts between their mothers and the new husbands, hoping to drum them out. Children born in the United States, jealous that their mothers are showering the newcomers with attention, tell lies about the new children, hoping to get them in trouble and shipped back. Some mothers, Murillo says, do many things right. They leave children with relatives who constantly emphasize that the parents left to help their children. They keep in constant contact during the separation. They are open and honest about their lives in the United States. They never promise anything, especially a visit or reunion, until they are positive they can deliver. Even in these cases, Murillo says the reunions are rocky. He has dealt with students who have tried to stab their mothers, who have asked to have guardianship transferred to someone else, who have turned suicidal. One mother says, I think it's like the Bible says, people will move around, but not find peace. Many reunified children, not finding the love they had hoped for with their mothers, search for love elsewhere. Some boys find a family in the local gangs and end up selling drugs. Some girls find unconditional love by getting pregnant, having a baby, and moving in with a father. Gangs and pregnancy are much more common among the children who have been reunited with their mothers than among those born here, says Zenaida Gabriel, a case manager at Sunrise Community Counseling Center, where some newcomer students go for help. Newcomer school psychologist Laura Lopez estimates that only 70 out of 430 students will complete high school. Indeed, immigration expert Jeffrey Passel says nearly half of all Central American children who arrive in the United States after the age of 10 don't graduate from high school. A Harvard University study found that immigrant children in U.S. schools who spent time separated from their parents were often depressed, act up, have trouble trusting anyone, and don't respond to the authority of parents they weren't raised with. Special education teacher Margo Rodriguez adds, "This isn't worth it. In the end, you lose your kids." But she admits she doesn't know what it's like not to have anything to feed to your hungry children. Oscar Escalda Hernandez, director of the Casa YMCA shelter for immigrant children in Tijuana, Mexico, agrees. The effect of immigration has been family disintegration. People are leaving behind the most important value, family unity. The survivors, like Enrique, try to block out problems with their mothers and focus on what is good for them and their futures. They work to ensure that the love they feel for their mothers overcomes the rancor they also feel. Lands left behind. The exodus of immigrants has been bittersweet for the countries they leave as well. Losing so much of the population has provided an escape valve for countries with enormous economic problems, such as Mexico and Honduras. It has kept unemployment from climbing even higher by allowing those who remain to have jobs the migrants would have taken otherwise. Immigrants also send huge amounts of money from the United States to their families back home, typically one-tenth of what they make, which contributes more than $40 billion a year to the Latin American economy. The cash flow makes up a whopping 15% of El Salvador's gross domestic product and is Mexico's second largest contributor to the economy, after oil. It is used for food, clothing, medical expenses, and to educate children. Grandparents who get money to care for children left behind would be destitute without the payments. Immigrants who return to their home countries also bring back skills they learned from living in a country with more technology, says Norberto Giron of the International Organization for Migration in Honduras. Immigrants' desire to communicate with families back home in Honduras has resulted in improved telephone and internet services. They bring lower levels of tolerance for corruption and stronger demands for democratic processes, says Honduran immigration expert Maureen Zamora. But the separation of children and parents has had lasting negative consequences in these Latin American countries. Huge groups of parentless children have fueled rampant growth in juvenile delinquency and gangs in Honduras, says Glenda Gallardo, principal economist with the United Nations Development Program. If your mom leaves you, if she disappears, it marks you in a way for life, she says. A disproportionate number of the 36,000 gangsters in Honduras come from families in which the mother has migrated north, says Zamora. Grandparents, guided by guilt that the child they are raising isn't with his mother, go light on discipline. They also worry that if the child complains and gets moved to another relative, the money the mother sends may go elsewhere as well. A public advertising campaign launched in 2002 is one sign Honduras is facing damage caused by family separations. The advertisements run on television and on the radio, and are plastered on billboards at the Tegucigalpa bus station, where Hondurans head north. Father, mother, reads an advertisement with a young girl on a swing. Your children need you. Stay here. In Honduras, there are opportunities to get ahead. Discover them. We are seeing a disintegration of the family, warns Norberto Giron, the Honduran migration official. Keeping the family together, even if they are poor, is more important than leaving and improving their economic conditions. Immigrant nation. Each year, the United States legally admits nearly a million people, more than twice as many as in the 1970s. Recession and greater border enforcement caused illegal immigration to drop by two-thirds since its peak in 2007. But 300,000 people still come to the United States unlawfully every year. Today, more than 41 million residents of the United States were born in another country. 28% of those live in the United States illegally. Despite the recent slowdown, the decade between 2000 and 2010 had the highest number of immigrants coming to the United States ever recorded. Today, while the proportion of people in the United States who are foreign-born is 13%, still slightly lower than the 15% peak reached in 1890, it has climbed from 5% in 1970. In California, more than one in four residents was born in another country. In Miami, more than 6 in 10 residents were born abroad. Some Mexicans and Mexican-Americans have jokingly dubbed the influx La Reconquista, the reconquest of lands in the United States that were once held by Mexico. Initially, Enrique and Lourdes disagree about the impact of this on the United States. Enrique says that were he an American citizen, he would want to restrict illegal immigration. Like most on his paint crew, he explains, he gets paid cash under the table, which is to say he does not contribute taxes on what he earns. He uses publicly provided services, including emergency medical care, and at times he has sent a portion of his income to Honduras rather than spending it in his community. Lourdes disagrees. Yes, she says her daughter was born at a public hospital, and she received welfare for a time. Still, she pays taxes and is entitled to those services. To her, immigrant labor is the engine that helps drive the American economy. Immigrants like her, she says, work hard at jobs no American wants to do, at least not for minimum wage with no health benefits or paid vacation time. Immigrants' willingness to do certain backbreaking jobs at low wages provides goods and services to all Americans at reasonable prices, she says. Over time, Enrique comes to think more like his mother on these issues. Immigrants, he says, clearly help the U.S. economy. He doesn't understand why police are targeting migrants. Many Americans understand that being born in the United States, with all the opportunities that come with citizenship, is a matter of sheer luck. They are happy to share the opportunities that the United States provides with people who are desperate for a shot at a better life. Others believe that previous U.S. policies toward Latin America have planted the seeds for the current wave of immigrants. In recent decades, the United States has supported and sometimes even helped install repressive regimes in Latin America. These regimes resisted reforms and fueled poverty, civil wars, and the resulting economic crisis that is now pushing so many Latin American citizens to migrate from their home countries to the United States. Today, demand in the United States for cocaine and marijuana has caused drug cartels and violence to boom south of the border. Employers in the United States see other benefits. Being in the country illegally motivates people like Enrique to do good work and keep their employment stable. They work hard to keep their jobs. It would be tough to get another job because they are in the country illegally and don't speak highly fluent English. Enrique says men on his paint crew who were born in the United States work slower, take more breaks, resist hard assignments, and demand to be paid higher rates for overtime. Many experts say immigrants help the economy grow and prevent businesses that rely on cheap labor from being forced to close or ship jobs abroad. Immigrant women make up the majority of some low-education occupations, like cleaning, babysitting, or factory work. Immigrant women who work as nannies and caregivers provide something invaluable, kindness and nurturing, often at the expense of their own children, says Christine M. Zentgroff, a sociology professor at California State University at Long Beach. A 1997 study by the National Research Council that is considered among the most comprehensive assessments of the effects of immigration showed that immigrants not only add a modest but significant boost to the nation's $16 trillion economy. They also lower the cost of nearly 5% of all goods and services everyone in America buys. Immigrants' biggest contribution, others say, is how their presence brings new blood, new ideas, and new ways of looking at things that drive creativity and spur advances. A disproportionate number of the nation's high achievers, the NRC study noted, such as Nobel laureates, are immigrants from around the world. Indeed, it is often the most motivated people who are immigrants. Who else would leave everything they know, cross Mexico on top of freight trains, and come to a place where they have to start from scratch? Benefit and burden. Oppositions to immigration include racism, a resistance to change, and a discomfort with having people around who don't speak the same language or have similar customs. Yet some of the negative consequences of immigration are real and are becoming increasingly evident as more women and children arrive. Overall, the NRC said, immigrants use more government services than the native-born. They have more children and therefore more youngsters in public schools. This is especially true for immigrants from Latin America, whose households are nearly twice as large as those of the native-born. It will cost the government 2.5 times as much per household to educate their children, the study found. Immigrants are poorer, have lower incomes, and qualify for more state and local services and assistance. Immigrant women receive publicly funded care during pregnancy. Their U.S.-born children are entitled to welfare, food stamps, and Medicaid. Compared to native households, immigrant families from Latin America are nearly 3 times as likely to receive government welfare payments for these children. Because immigrants earn less money and are less likely to own property, they pay lower taxes. Some immigrants receive their salaries in cash and pay no taxes at all. In all, immigrants and their native-born children pay a third less tax per capita than others in the United States, the NRC study found. Households headed by immigrants from Latin America pay half of what natives pay in state and federal taxes. The fiscal burden to taxpayers is greatest in immigrant-heavy states, such as California, where an estimated half of all children have immigrant parents. The biggest expense comes from educating migrants' children in public schools, a cost borne by local and state. More in state and local taxes than the value of the services they received. Conversely, immigrant households paid $3,463 less than the value of the services they received, the NRC found. The crush of immigrants has hastened the deterioration of many public services, namely schools, hospitals, and state jails and prisons. Classrooms are crowded, Hospital emergency rooms have been forced to close, in part because so many poor, uninsured, non-paying patients, including immigrants, are provided with free mandated care. In Los Angeles County, jails have had to release prisoners early because of overcrowding caused in part by criminal immigrants. The Center for Immigration Studies, which seeks reduced immigration levels, found that in 2002, nationwide, households headed by illegal immigrants used $26.3 billion in government services and paid $16 billion in taxes. Those hardest hit by the influx of immigrants are disadvantaged native-born minorities who don't have a high school degree, namely African Americans and previous waves of Latino immigrants. They must compete for the same low-end jobs immigrants take. Wages for high school dropouts, who make up 1 in 14 native workers, have dropped in recent years. Between 1980 and 2000, a Harvard University study found the influx of immigrant workers to the United States cut wages for native workers with no high school diploma by 7.4%, or $1,800 on an average salary of $25,000. Sometimes whole industries switch from native to immigrant workers. In 1993, I looked at efforts to unionize Latino janitors in Los Angeles. Previously, the jobs had been largely held by African Americans who had succeeded in obtaining increased wages and health benefits. Cleaning companies busted their union and then brought in Latino immigrant workers at half the wages and no benefits. The employers benefited because they no longer had to treat their workers well. They are able to get away with this for the same reason that gangster violence and crime in Mexico toward Central Americans has gone underreported. If immigrants went to the police to complain, they would be found out as illegal and deported. In 1996, I went to an ordinary block of two-bedroom homes in East Los Angeles to understand why nearly a third of California Latinos had supported Proposition 187, a voter initiative to bar illegal immigrants from schools, hospitals, and most public assistance. The measure passed and was later struck down by the courts. For residents of the block, ill feelings toward unlawful immigrants were grounded in how the newcomers had affected their neighborhood and their lives. For them, the influx had meant not cut-rate nannies and gardeners, but heightened job competition, depressed wages, overcrowded government services, and a reduced quality of life. The newcomers who moved into the neighborhood were poor. Residents estimated that the block's population had tripled since 1970. Up to 17 immigrants were jammed into one small stucco house. Some lived in garages without plumbing, using lawns to relieve themselves. The second and third generation Latinos on the block felt it was their working class neighborhoods that bore the brunt of a wave of impoverished, unskilled workers. Immigrants were arriving at an unsettling pace, crowding them out of jobs and lowering wages. Immigrants weren't just taking the jobs that natives didn't covet. They competed with the natives for work as painters, mechanics, and construction workers. In the 1980s, the RAND Corporation, a Santa Monica think tank, found that the benefits of immigration outweighed the costs. By 1997, they had reversed course. The economy wasn't producing new jobs for high school dropouts, an increasing proportion of whom, roughly half, were unemployed. RAND said some native adults had become unemployed because of immigrant competition. They recommended the country slash legal immigration to 1970s levels. Some immigration experts question whether it makes sense to allow in so many immigrants from poor, underdeveloped countries with low levels of education when the United States needs to compete globally in industries that require high levels of education, creativity, and know-how. Mexican immigrants arrive with an average of 5 to 9 years of education. Others, experts focus on how adding more than 1 million immigrants a year to the U.S. population affects overcrowding of parks, freeways, and the environment. Immigration accounted for more than half of the 33 million new U.S. residents in the 1990s. With nearly 315 million people, the United States has more than five times as many residents as when Ellis Island first welcomed new arrivals. In Los Angeles County, the surge in immigrants helped cause the poverty rate to nearly double to 25% between 1980 and 1997. The effect, at least in the short term, was to have a sea of poor and working-class neighborhoods amid islands of affluence. Schizophrenic policies. In the end, any calculus of the benefits and burdens of immigration depends on who you are. People who own businesses and commercial interests that use cheap immigrant labor benefit the most from immigrants like Enrique and Lourdes. They get a ready supply of compliant low-cost workers. Other winners are couples who hire immigrants to care for their children and drive them to school, as well as to tend to their lawns, clean their houses, and wash their cars. Polls show Americans in recent years have hardened their view of immigrants, particularly those who are in the country illegally. A growing proportion thinks the government should reduce immigration from current levels. Many immigration observers believe U.S. officials have pursued a purposefully schizophrenic immigration policy. The government spends $11.9 billion a year on border enforcement and has five times as many Border Patrol agents along the nation's southwestern border as when the crackdown began in the 1990s. It has walled off nearly 700 miles of that divide. Politicians talk tough about catching illegal immigrants. But labor-intensive industries such as agriculture, construction, food processing, restaurants, and domestic help agencies want cheap immigrant labor to bolster their bottom lines. And meanwhile, critics say efforts to enforce many of the nation's immigration laws remain weak. Whenever immigration authorities make even passing attempts to enforce a 1986 law that allows employers to be fined up to $10,000 for each illegal immigrant they hire, some employers, onion farmers in Georgia, meat packing firms in the Midwest, bitterly complain. And labor-intensive industries want cheap immigrant labor to bolster their bottom lines. President Obama has conducted silent raids of thousands of businesses, including Chipotle and American Apparel, requiring them to produce documents showing that employees' Social Security numbers and names match, or those employees must be fired. The government has imposed more than $100 million in fines, but employees say that without biometric markers, workers can simply provide employers the same name and Social Security number and be fine. Similarly, a pilot project allowing some employers to check the immigration status of job applicants via telephone has never expanded nationally and remains voluntary on the federal level and in most states. Recently, the legislative drive to enact anti-immigrant legislation has cooled, with 40% fewer bills introduced and 20% fewer bills passed by states in the first half of 2012. No Arizona-style bills have passed in 2012. In Georgia, where 2011's anti-immigrant legislation meant 40% of agricultural workers left the state, resulting in $140 million in crops rotting in the fields for lack of pickers, politicians are hearing from powerful business interests. In Arizona, five additional immigration bills proposed were soundly defeated, and the state senator and architect of the original immigration law was recalled. Demographics are also causing lawmakers to reconsider, especially since Latinos, who are considered socially conservative and not necessarily a lock for the Democratic Party, will go from 17% to 30% of the population in 2050. pushing anti-immigrant legislation might mean election defeat. In California, for instance, Proposition 187, the 1994 bill that denied unlawful immigrants access to all government services, including K-12 education, alienated Latinos from the state's Republican Party. Today, no Republican holds statewide office in California. In 2012, President Obama gained an election advantage by signing an executive order that allowed two-year relief from deportation for 1.7 million immigrants who came to the United States unlawfully as children. For decades, politicians have put a lock on the front door while swinging the back door wide open. A crackdown on the United States-Mexico border, begun in 1993, was designed to shift immigrant traffic to more remote parts of the border, where Border Patrol agents have a tactical advantage. Since the buildup began, the numbers of agents patrolling the border and the amount of money spent on enforcement have both tripled, according to a 2002 study by the Public Policy Institute of California, PPIC. Yet there is no evidence, the PPIC concluded, that the strategy has worked. In fact, the number of immigrants in the United States illegally has grown more quickly since the border buildup began, at least until the recession made migrants realize they would be making the trip with no payoff. More illegal immigrants now use smugglers, 90%, as compared to 70% before. Immigrants, particularly those from Mexico, once returned home after brief work stints in the United States. Today, the increasing difficulty and cost of crossing means more come and stay. The new strategy has also resulted in more than 300 deaths each year as migrants are forced to cross in areas that are less populated, more isolated, and more geographically hostile. Some priests in Mexico whose churches are located near the rails are so sure the flow of Central American migrants will be never-ending that they have recently built their own migrant shelters. As long as the degree of poverty Lourdes lived in exists, it is most likely that people will try to get to the United States, even if they must take enormous risks to get here. There is a clear pattern in U.S. history. When we need labor, we welcome migrants. When we are in recession, we want them to leave. During the Great Depression, the United States deported 1 million people of Mexican origin, including half who were in the country legally. During World War II, when labor was scarce, we started the massive Bracero guest worker program. In fiscal 2011, the U.S. Border Patrol saw a 40-year low in the apprehension of illegal immigrants, just 340,000 compared to 1.68 million in 2000. As the economy improves, will there be another influx and the inevitable backlash? In the United States, many immigration experts have concluded that the only effective strategy for change is to improve the economies of immigrant-sending countries, so people will not want to or need to leave. Hondurans point out a few things that would help bring that about. They say the United States should promote more democratic governments that are willing to take on corruption and redistribute wealth. What if the Honduran government, like Mexico's, promoted family planning? In Mexico, that one campaign, reducing the number of children per family to 2.2 in 2012 from 6.8 in 1970, is perhaps the single most significant change affecting the need to migrate. If the United States gave a strong preference to trading goods from immigrant-sending countries, it would help spur growth in certain industries that employ women in Honduras, such as textiles. Others believe the United States, a country that is known to be stingy with foreign aid compared with other industrial countries, should give more donations. Individuals, Hondurans note, can support non-governmental organizations that encourage job-creating small businesses or improve the availability of education in Honduras, where 11% of children never attend school. More women and children around the world are migrating, an exodus predicted to grow in the coming years. Already, of the 214 million migrants worldwide, 49% are women. Save the Children says there are tens of millions of mobility orphans, children left behind by parents, like Lourdes did with Enrique. Most immigrants would rather stay in their home countries with their extended families. Who wants to leave home and everything he or she knows for something foreign, not knowing if he or she will ever return? Not many. What would ensure that more women can stay home with their children where they want to be? Maria Isabel's mother, Eva, says simply, there would have to be jobs. Jobs that pay okay. That's all.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Enrique's Journey, written by Sonia Nazario, performed by Catherine Byers, executive producer Maria Olson, supervising producer Mike Charzik, producer Gail Hendricks, production coordinator Kat Lambricks, music by Michael Whalen, copyright 2006 by Sonia Nazario, production copyright 2008 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.